Welcome to A Life Beyond Sport. My name is Nick Keller. I'm your host and the founder of Beyond Sport. And each episode, I've got to sit with some amazing people from public life and hear about their life's journey through their three most meaningful sports story. It's our first birthday today. Can you believe it? A whole year. We've had an amazing journey through 34 episodes, meeting some remarkable people from presidents, Olympians to business giants and gangsters. We have literally heard it all. Today's show is a bit of a metaphor for sport's impact on the world. The highs, the lows, the setbacks, the joys of the world's favourite pastime. Thanks for joining us if it's your first time, and thanks for being so loyal if you've been with us all the way through the journey. But sit back and enjoy a fantastic pod bringing all the best stories together. So how do you get 34 cracking episodes into around 1 hour? Well, we've split everything up into four areas: setbacks, joy, insights, and the future. So we set off with setbacks. Now, the great thing about sport, and people say it, that you learn from your failures and you pick yourself up. And we've certainly got four amazing stories coming your way. We start with Tanaya Sam, the infamous leader of the Burger Bar Boys Birmingham gang. You try saying that yourselves. We then hear from Ebony Rainford Brent, Frank Warren, and then into an unbelievable, life-changing story from Richard Lapchick. But we start, as I said, with Tanaya.
As someone who's had my own mental health challenges around anxiety, I was thinking about how do you cope with the chaos of it all? How do you cope with the anxiety and the fear and the simple notion that you're putting yourself into such a perilous situation?
Now I understand how I coped with it, but at the time, no. But smoking weed day in, day out, especially at night. Drinking was, you know, it was drinking alcohol, because seeing the elders drinking Guinness and seeing the elders drinking, you know, rum and actually say, you know, drinking Baileys and getting involved in doing that type of stuff, having sessions.
Baileys, I wouldn't say is the hard-edged, I didn't know that was the hard-edged alcohol of the gang community.
No, you know, when you're chilling out, Baileys was, yeah, Baileys was definitely the one. A lot of that's like self-medication, isn't it?
Yeah.
You're just smoking and drinking, and all you're doing is you're blocking stuff out. That's what you're trying to do at the time. You're blocking stuff out, and then you're trying to do things that will enable your ego to feel satisfied. So it's girls and being, you know, promiscuous within the community with the females, and you're just trying to get a high for yourself. And that is what I was doing, and what I saw others doing. But you know, that lifestyle really addictive. What I try to explain to my colleagues and fellow professionals is that, you know, that lifestyle, you know, being on the streets, it's an adrenaline rush. And so, you know, some of these things that unfortunately young people are doing, you know, shootings and stabbings, and it's an high. There's actually a high to it. You know, and I remember explaining the high of, you know, having a gun and firing a gun, and I was explaining it to a girl, and she was like, "Well, that was similar to when I did the parachuting." And so I do believe there's a connection in terms of that adrenaline rush. Why some of the young people at the time, when they're involved, they kind of carry on with it, because it's pretty addictive, you know. But it's scary. It's scary, but there's a rush to it. So you go back to trying to have that feeling again.
I'd had back issues for a long time as a kid. And when I was about 19, I went up to an England training thing and my back was feeling dodgy. Went home, bent down and tried to pick up a remote, fell down and never got up properly to walk for a year. Turned out I had all these problems, pars defects, prolapsed discs. I didn't even know how bad it was. And I was told by the doctor after they did the MRI, it was unlikely I'd ever play sport again. And so, you know, we didn't have the investment then that we maybe had now, because it might have been dealt with quicker, but I went into a year of not being able to walk properly. So left university, told I'd never play sport, and just kind of hit this dark depression place of, you know, putting on weight and staying in my basement and never opening the curtains. So it was mentally, it was quite a dark place to be. But what two things really happened that shifted how I see the world now anyway is my brother gave me a serious F-bomb conversation, and his words were, you know, you've chosen to accept the reality of the doctors. And I don't know, you just normally accept what you've been told. You know, this is what they've said, that's what I believe. And he really shook me up with a harsh conversation. And I think the second thing is my mum gave me all these like books and motivational DVDs and everything like that, which I soaked up. And what I did is I wrote like quite clearly what my next sort of 5 years would be. And it was to get back and play for England. I wanted to be part of the World Cup team in 2009. So this was written. I wanted to get back to university, finish and get a master's in chemistry. So it was like a 5-year vision. And just staring at that every day, going from like limping and not even being able to walk to a year to run, a year to build up, etc., was, I suppose, the moment that developed my steel as a person, my inner steel. And so I just think it's one of the most, how to describe it, the most defining moments for shaping me as, since I've come out of that. I just realize now, you know, you can get so much more out of yourself if you have a vision and you kind of have a better process for dealing with adversity.
I suppose it's funny that you, when you turn to sport as a very young person, to probably hide away a little bit,
and massively
and it becomes so rooted into your core ego system survival structure that when it's under threat, you probably went and just ignored the threat, because
100%
wasn't just your back's gonna go, everything's gonna go. It's a house of cards, isn't it, really?
It is. Yeah, exactly. And I think I see sometimes that there's like a little streak of, I don't know what the word is, but in sport, some sports players like who just keep pushing and always, you know, and this is why you need sometimes good people around you, because sometimes the reason why you're striving so hard and you're putting yourself through those extra, you know, pains and stuff like that is to do with a little demon door, you know, and sometimes it can make people successful because you know, maybe you go so far, you push past, you know, barriers that others wouldn't. But equally, you're right. I think it was so built into sport was my kind of way out, and this is my acceptance piece, and this is everything. And I just didn't ever want to stop that.
And that year, 89, was quite a significant year because, you know, I intimated earlier that you have half a lung, and that's because you were shot, which I rarely get to say that to any human being I ever meet. Did it affect you mentally at all to think, does someone hate me that much?
No, I at the time, I couldn't make out why it happened. Mm. I really couldn't. And I was angry. And like, you know, listen, when I was a kid, I was never shying in sticking up for myself. And obviously my natural instinct and reaction was to get my own back. I was absolutely, you know, sound stupid, angry. I was very angry about it all. And it caused me a lot of problems financially with my businesses. We built London Arena in Docklands. And I was just put together a syndication deal with a group of banks who were going to take equity in the arena for a lot of money. And the arena, I think, was on about 7-8 acres of land in Docklands. Had consent to build four tower blocks on the corner of each corner of the arena. And so, you know, I worked very hard to get the arena up and running. That was tough enough. And the interest rate went to 16%. We were paying a couple of over, so you hit nearly 20% interest. And this happened, and everybody just sort of basically, you know, the deal just went out the window, just ended. That it didn't happen. So it was the anger of that, of how it affected me, the security of my family. And eventually, you know, it fell into place. I didn't know who it was. And then I did know who it was. then it hit me who it was.
What Fran, how do you pick yourself up? You know, what's the one thing you'd say to people who are listening to this over how you pick yourself up from that moment? Business, family, health, all in a particularly vulnerable place. What's the one thing you held on to when you were coming through that?
I think my resolve. You know, I was determined to get, I actually discharged myself from hospital and I'd lost about, I went down to just over 9 stone in weight. That's how much weight I lost as a result of it. And it was just the fact that I had to do it. I had to, otherwise, you know, I'd have been out of the game. My family would have suffered, you know, all what I wanted for my children, the education, the private education that I wanted for them, to see, you know, to do better with their education than I did, you know, the whole package, the business, I had to get back into it. So I discharged myself, and again, I was quite weak and hadn't lost the weight and so forth, but I did and got on with it. And at the end of the day, you know, people got a lot of sympathy, you know, good friends, a lot of people were very good towards me. Some friends disappeared, but they, you know, when the chips are down, who your mates are. And I did get some support, but at the end of the day, the only one who was going to give me support was myself. And I had to show that I could do it. So I got discharged myself, and I was back in the office probably about 3 weeks later.
The next night I was working late in my college office, which was in the school's library. The library closed at 10:30. At 10:45, there was a knock on the door, and I assumed it was campus security who would routinely check if they saw lights on in the building after it was closed. So I didn't hesitate to open the door, Nick. And when I did, instead of two security guards, it was two men wearing stocking masks who proceeded to cause liver damage, kidney damage, a hernia, concussion, and carved the N-word in my stomach with a pair of office scissors. That night in the hospital, Nick, I knew as I reflected on things that if people had gone to the length they did to try to stop my father 28 years before and the length they did to try to stop me then, that they must have thought we were having a powerful impact on racism in America and in South Africa by using that sports platform. And I decided literally that night that I was going to spend the rest of my life figuring out ways to use the sports platform to address various social justice issues, particularly racism, but also other social justice issues as the years moved on.
But dwelling on that personal sacrifice that you made, was there any moment of time while you were sitting in that hospital bed thinking that I'm moving to a place that is way too dangerous for myself? And the doubts must have been unbelievable in those moments.
Well, a lot of people were saying, you've got to stop doing this. You've got to stop taking these risks. And that was true over the next few days as well. But I think that, you know, another thing took place that first night in the hospital, and that was, I never fell asleep because of the thoughts that you're referring to, just racing through my mind about what I was going to do. Would I continue doing it? I'm guessing at about 4 a.m., Nick, I heard three women talking out in the corridor, and I couldn't identify them, but I didn't really try to. And then one by one, they came in thinking I was asleep and leaned over and kissed my hand. And I realized there were three black nurses. And when they went back out into the corridor, I heard one say to the other two, I didn't think white people cared. And that had a powerful impact on me because I knew a lot of white people who cared.
Wow, sometimes my guests have stopped me in my tracks, and that was certainly one of those moments. If you enjoyed that, go and listen to Richard's full podcast. He's one of those remarkable people that has been fighting inequality in the world and in sport for many, many decades, hugely poignant at this time. And of course, we know that although sport does help us in times of failure and offers setbacks, it also provides some of those remarkable, joyful moments where you leap so high that you find friendship, you laugh so hard, and that you celebrate so much that time just stands still. Our first story comes from a prime minister who only really danced a jig twice in a 10-year tenure, and one of them was a sporting moment. So enjoy that. Then we hear from Tim Shriver and his stunning try he'll never forget, Charlie Martin, Brett Gosper, and then finally, a classic story from a classic storyteller, the CEO of Unilever, Alan Jope.
It was an extraordinary thing from beginning to end. I was only really persuaded by Tessa Jowell, the wonderful Tessa, that we should bid. Yeah. I really didn't think we would win. We had very strong competition from Paris. Strong competition from Madrid as well. And we were quite late starters in it. And so, but we then, once we decided to go for it, I personally put a lot of effort into it. We then went to Singapore, which is where the bid was being decided by the International Olympic Committee. And then I had this extraordinary 2 or 3 days where I went to Singapore. I then had to go back before the result was declared to host the G7, or G8, as it was at that time, in Gleneagles in Scotland in 2005, in July 2005. And that weekend, three extraordinary things happened. One was that we won the Olympic bid. The second was that we had the terrible terrorist attacks in London on the 7th of July. And the third was that we agreed what was the biggest program ever for Africa and the developing world that the developed world had ever put together. So it was an extraordinary 3 days. But the moment that I heard that we'd won the Olympics was just a great, great moment. I mean, as I always say to people, in politics, there are very few unalloyed moments of joy.
Yeah.
Signing of the Good Friday Peace Agreement in Northern Ireland was one that stands out. The other is the winning of that Olympic bid. And when the news came through, I literally danced the jig with my chief of staff, Jonathan Powell. If you know Jonathan, he's not someone given to that sort of thing, but I was just so, so happy.
So if you play rugby for Yale, you know, the oldest rivalry in collegiate sport is Harvard-Yale rugby. I mean, people think of American football, or they think of obviously soccer, European football. They think of all these other sports, basketball, of course, nowadays. But the oldest rivalry is rugby. We go back 150, almost 130. So, you know, the last game of the year is the Harvard-Yale game, and it's the Harvard-Yale rugby game. So on a cold Saturday morning in Cambridge, we met the Harvard team met us, and you know, they were favored. I dare say, I won't go poetic here. They were favored, a bit bigger, a bit faster, but not as tough.
Let loose, Tim. Let loose. Come on, let it go.
But it was just a beautiful try, for God's sakes. I mean, it was. I don't know how many phases we had. I think three or four. I play fly half. So, of course, those of your listeners who know, I took the ball deep in our own territory, deep in our own territory. There's a break, I think, at outside center, as I remember. A second phase quickly developed. We came to the right side. And then we had the third phase, and I put the ball to the outside inside center. We had a brilliant inside center. He became an All-American, fast as lightning. And, you know, once he had the ball, if he broke, it was lights out. But on this particular break, he broke through the line. He was moving down the field, headed right for the posts. And, you know, the fullback was there and a crossing wing forward was there, but I kept pace right on his shoulder. And at the last minute, he gave me a perfect pass to his inside, and boy did I just dart around that wing forward right under the post. The glory of the world was upon me. The light shone through the skies. We won the game. The whistle came a minute or two later. The party that night, I developed my own song, which I won't sing for you.
No, you can't say that and not sing it now. You've got no choice now.
On the outside chance that anyone else on that team hears this, I won't embarrass myself, because they get disgusted by me talking about this try. But no, it was wonderful. But you know, all it is a couple of kids.
I just want to remind the listeners that this is over 45 years ago, and your memory of it is so beautifully acute. It's wonderful.
See, the thing is, right, what I'll tell people is being at Man City, being at Wembley in 99, we came back from 2-0 down against Gillingham, being at the Etihad in 2012 when Aguero scored that goal, I'm telling you now, better than winning a World Cup. And people go, what are you talking about? It's just because when you're playing in the sport, you're in the moment, you're doing your job. I know everyone likes to build it up. It's like, wow, aren't you internationally amazing? It's like, no, you're just doing your job. You're just doing what you've been taught to do. You're in the moment. You're fixing problems. The plan's not going right. Change the plan. Work out a way to win. Change tactics. Roll your sleeves up. You've got to win ugly today. Beautiful. Everything's perfect. Great. But you're in control as a fan. Fans are not in control. You just, your hopes, it's the hope that kills you. And you turn up, and those moments for me, I've got more vivid memories. I've got more things that I will talk about with my son and my brother and my cousins. Being at Wembley, being at the Etihad, than I will about beating New Zealand in New Zealand.
But if you've got 80,000 people screaming and shouting at you, and you're doing your work, and you don't hear it.
No, you're out there, and some of the lads. I mean, I was one of the ones who may have heard it and may have listened and was checking if Take That was on the Tannoy or Oasis Wonderwall, and where were my mates and waving at them. One of my things was switching off in between plays and having a look around at other lads. I mean, they were like robots. It's just the least enjoyable, because you know, A, it bloody hurts, and B, you're just trying to stay in the zone and focused. So I don't always buy in. You know, I think it's this thing that most of us don't want to deny these things and burst bubbles of fans. But being at Medina as a supporter and the miracle of Medina, being at Augusta. I've had way more fun as a supporter than I have often as a player. Feeling sick, violently sick about playing, than I had as a fan. I'm not trying to undermine it. Of course, I wouldn't swap it. But in my speaker of truth capacity, in my only tell the truth and you don't have to remember anything, I had more fun. Now, if you said to me now, go back to the Aguero goal or go back to playing against Wales at Cardiff, oh my God, I want to be at the Etihad. Mate, the stadium moved. It was unbelievable.
Going back to racing in that first year, which was incredibly tough and scary and, you know, but exhilarating at the same time because I knew I'd taken that leap into the unknown, and I was back racing.
You know, everyone else knew you pre-transition.
Yeah.
And you're heading back in to the same group of people as a woman. I mean, that's that sounds pretty terrifying.
It was. I mean, the first time I went back to without my car, just to see, you know, just to go and see everyone and see if I had a future in motorsport, because at that point in time, I told myself, I'm done. I'm finished. I'm giving up. I don't want, you know, motorsport is one huge extended family. It's that feeling of community and belonging that is one of the most essential ingredients of what I love about being in a race paddock, sharing that time with all the other petrol heads, sharing your passion. And I felt like I'm not going to be welcome anymore. And you take that all away, and suddenly, what have you got? I didn't want to be a part of that. I didn't want to see something I love become something I hated. So when I walked back in the paddock for the first time, I was shaking. You know, I was physically shaking. I was terrified. And of probably 300 or so people I knew at that race, I just walked into a sea of blank faces. You can imagine how that feels. and probably 7 or 8 of my best friends that I raced with in my class came over and saw me. They knew I was coming that day. They gave me a big hug, you know, all smiles. So happy to see you. So glad you're back. How are you doing? And I don't know if those people will ever fully appreciate what that gesture meant to me, because we all felt awkward and it was a bit uncomfortable, but it was genuine. It was from the heart. And I think if they hadn't have done that, I'd probably never have gone back to racing the next season. And I wouldn't have done half of the things I've done since. It's such a pivotal moment for me that really decided so much of what came after it.
And I'd imagine you had the fixtures down in the southwest of the country were particularly precious, I'd imagine.
Well, but most of them were down there because there's really no elite rugby north of Paris. And in those days, Stade Francais didn't. They're in third division. So we were the Paris team. And when we played in places like Perpignan and other places, we were absolutely booed and spat on. We were the Parisian, and we played into that. We, the whole pink bow tie thing started from us doing all sorts of stunts that were really to show that we were all about entertainment and showbiz, and we called ourselves the showbiz. Mm. And we played games with, you know, French berets in Bayonne. We came on bicycles and did a lap of the field. We wore bald wigs for one game in dedication to the then commentator, Pierre Salviac, who was bald. We did all sorts of stunts. We actually tried to get approval to land at a game in a helicopter over Colombe, which was our home ground, but they didn't grant us airspace to do that. But we built up these things. Then and this was the year of 87 that we ended up in the final with pink bow ties. We came on in blazers at Montferrand for the quarterfinals against Brive and saluted the crowd like arrogant, you know, stars. And all of this would just incite, you know, the opposition would just not be able to see the ball for the first 20 minutes. They were so pissed off with us.
It's like a more entertaining form of the haka, really.
Well, it was just, we used to have meetings on a Thursday and say, what are we going to do this weekend?
Yeah.
We're going to lose, so we need to go out with a bang. We kept winning. And, you know, we ended up in the final in the year. We were nowhere near good enough to be in a final. Yeah. The coup de grace was, what are we going to do for the final? We'll wear pink bow ties. And, of course, everyone ran on with pink bow ties. The backs played the entire game with the pink bow ties. The television audience for that 87 game was 8 million people, which is a final of a Six Nations these days, and a record crowd at the Parc des Princes, because those stunts transcended the sport at the time. And you know, some of the time that the backs also put out a single and were appearing on variety shows, and the whole of France were fascinated by this phenomena of what was called the showbiz at the time, which then became the Eden Park brand, ultimately.
As an ad agency man at the time, were you under pressure to come up with the best ideas for the team?
Well, it was all part of it. I think the group were better marketers than I ever will be, but together we did come up with some ideas, to the point where there was a Six Nations weekend cancelled, totally cancelled due to snow. That would have been 86, 87. Mm. And they had 2 or 3 hours of airtime booked on the biggest free-to-air state like the BBC. And we got a call saying, would the showbiz fill that 2 hours with sketches and interviews and highlights? And we did. But we had to meet and rehearse sketches at a bar called the Washington Square in Paris. All night we were rehearsing and absolutely shitting ourselves about this live slot we had the next day. But we did it, and on we went. And as I say, the boys put out a single that went lead, by the way, but had them on every had them on every entertainment show. So it was a very special period, that whole decade with the team. And as I say, it culminated in a couple of finals, one unsuccessful and one successful.
So we were posted out to Thailand, to Bangkok, and it was in 1996. I did the calculation. I think I would have been 32 at the time, and had packed up playing low-level rugby for London Scottish a few years earlier. And one of my buddies and I decided it might be a bit of a wheeze to set up a football team. And so we persuaded Delaney's, which was the pub that we drank at, to sponsor the team. And we bought a bunch of shirts, really badly designed for the Southeast Asian heat. They were thick cotton football shirts. And we started playing some league games. It was my first introduction really to organized football. Boy, we had people there from all walks of life. And I still am in touch with some of them. One of them, I won't say his name, I'm absolutely sure to this day was a spy, because he showed up and it wasn't clear what work he did. And he suddenly was able to speak fluent Thai. Another, believe it or not, was a retired porn star. And then we had teachers, we had business people, really people from all walks of life.
Yeah.
And one story that springs to mind is our goalie, Matt Batlakat, was leaving Bangkok to go live in San Francisco. And we, when someone left who was a longtime player, we typically went for a weekend tour. And that would normally be down to Pattaya or up to Chiang Mai or something. But we were getting bored of that. And I called our distributor in Laos and said, can you fix us up with a game of football? And he said, yeah, sure. Send the details of your team. So we sort of made up some playing credentials and faxed them through to the Unilever distributor in Laos. And then on a Friday, we hopped on a plane to Vientiane. The plane landed. And there was a bloody crowd. There was a crowd with flags and banners and welcome Delaney's to Laos. And we got whipped off to the Ministry of Sport, only for the penny to drop that we were playing the Lao national team who had just beaten Malaysia in the Asian Cup in the national stadium on the Sunday morning. The only sports story in the English newspaper was the big football game. And we were, you know, a bunch of fat drunks. In the end, the minister took me to one side and said, "Listen, you've got to take it easy on us. Don't go more than two goals ahead." And I said, "There's been a terrible misunderstanding." And it was televised. The game was televised, actually, and we lost 7-2, which we all were absolutely thrilled with.
That Alan Jope story, it's all in the telling, some would say. Anyway, go and listen, because that whole pod, I think it's our most listened to pod, is a complete classic, and his humour and joy of sport really does come out. We've listened to some amazing people over 34 episodes, and they've been really insightful, very intelligent people. But here we hear from three amazing leaders, Brian Dawkins, Andrew Strauss, and General Martin Dempsey. I love the Brian Dawkins story because I love to see big hitters in sport. And Brian Dawkins was one of the best and one of the greatest. Hear him talking about the intelligence and the violence of a tackle. It's a joy. Andrew Strauss, a deeply meaningful conversation, an insightful conversation. And finally, the General Martin Dempsey, former chairman of the Joint Chief of Staff under President Obama. Some amazing leadership stories from him, but go back and listen to his pod was so good, we had to split it into two. So anyway, some great insights from some great leaders.
You've gone on to become one of the greatest defensive players in NFL history, and Hall of Famer and seven Pro Bowls. But the real thing you've been known for, with a nickname of Weapon X, was your sheer joy of hitting people very, very hard.
Loved it. Still love it to this day. Yeah. Still love it to this day.
Who do you hit now? You don't hit anyone now, though. There's no one to hit, is there? Or?
No, I hit the weight room. I still.
I was worried.
I still hit the weight room. Still get in there, get some things done in there. Man, but there's just something about delivering that big hit to someone, the changing the mindset of an individual from coming in your direction because of that hit, that pounding, that pressure. If I can get in your head, if I can get you to think about me hitting you, you won't be thinking about your job that much, right? So it's a mental thing as well, because you don't want to come. And if you do come my way, you might not run as aggressively as you would had I not been over there. And then in those instances, I can take advantage of that sometimes, because I can also cause fumbles, because I'm not so much thinking about you trying to just punish me, because I've already punished you. So now I can go to the next step And our next step is to take advantage of you not coming hard at me.
So So how important is the first hit? It sounds like the first hit, that first few minutes of the game.
So important. So important. Even when someone is blocking me, I had it in my mind that if a receiver or anybody's coming to block me, I'm going to try my best to give them as much as I can on that first hit. So sometimes it's if an offensive lineman is coming, he's bigger than me, I'm going to cut him as hard as I can. Cut him. Go directly at his moneymakers, right? The people they call your legs, your moneymakers. Go right at his moneymakers, right? So the next time he's thinking I'm going to go at his moneymakers. No, I'm going to hit him in his chops that second time. So there's a game being played. And the next time, you don't know what I'm going to do. So the next time, I'll probably just avoid you because you don't know how I'm going to come at you. So there's a game being played. But physicality has to be the prime. It's the prime. And it's the fastball, so to speak.
So it's not just violence, is it? It's not just violence. It sounds like you think about it deeply, but it sounds like you can switch on. It sounds like you can switch on the anger and the level of intent that you need quite quickly. But it sounds like you do it in quite a thoughtful way. I don't know where the chops are, but it sounds different from the moneymakers. And you're putting some deep thought into what's going on here.
Absolutely. So your chops is your mouth.
Okay.
Hit you right in your mouth, right? Your moneymakers are your legs. So yeah.
Anything else? Any other parts of the body you've reclaimed?
I probably will say it as the further we go down in this conversation. When I learned to focus my energies as a youngster, as a youth, I was able to carry that on into other areas of my life and other areas of football as well. So to be able to, in practice, to go hard enough, but not too far so I won't hurt my teammate. But in the game time, I'm going to go even harder. There's another level that I can get to, and I know I can go to that place. And certain things I know, certain areas I know I can hit you that I'm not going to hit my teammate. But you, I don't know you. And even if I did, you're on the wrong team. So you got the wrong jersey on. Yeah. So it's all lovely for me to do whatever I need to do to get you off of the spot that I want to be in. That's what it's about. It's about moving a grown man from a spot that he does not want to be to another spot so that you can make a play on somebody else. So that there's a lot of force that needs to be applied. So the leverage is key. Mindset is key. And then the thought and the knowing that I can do it is key. And so that's the belief in the person that I was, the player that I was. And so you talk about Wolverine. Wolverine is not the biggest of dudes in comics. He's extremely short. Matter of fact, Sabretooth always calls him the shrimp because he's very short, right? But that does not stop his, you can't measure a dude's heart. You can't measure his willingness or what he's willing to do to get the job done. And that's the type of cat he was. Animalistic, you know, he'll go crazy on a person, but it's controlled chaos. I love that. He would have controlled chaos. That's how I tried to play, a controlled chaos.
I wanted to talk about love with you, and I didn't know what the question was to ask you about it, because I think there's so few conversations that men have with each other about the love of their partner.
And I agree with you, but I would also say, a couple of things on that, actually. You know, I've said in a number of different interviews over the last sort of couple of years that the last year of Ruth's life was the best year of our marriage in a lot of ways because our focus was on each other.
Mm.
You know, I stopped working. We were very much living around, you know, her itinerary of treatment and, you know, side effects and, you know, when she was feeling well and when she wasn't feeling well. And when we had opportunities, we'd do things as a family together. Really kind of really wholesome stuff. The stuff that we all talk about that families should do together, but we often don't have the time to because life gets in the way. And, you know, that was one year that life didn't get in the way for us. And so, you know, I think my overall, I certainly have regrets that life got in the way so much for Ruth and I. You know, we always had a very close relationship. You know, we were each other's best friends, et cetera, et cetera. But I spent years and years and years away from home. playing cricket for England, being on tour, doing loads of commercial things and you know, dinners and all these sort of things that you, as a professional sportsman, you're sort of both, you know, you're asked to, but you also feel obliged to turn up for it. And often it was at the expense of Ruth and the boys. And so, you know, I definitely have regrets on that. And I'm just so grateful in a way that we had that year to really focus on what's important. And, you know, obviously I'm utterly devastated that we only had a year and we didn't have more time because, you know, like always, there's so much more you wanted to say and do. And that time, that precious time you wanted to spend together was never enough.
When I entered the military, the population of the world was just under 5 billion, as I recall, or 1974. Now it's just under 8. So even if we just say, okay, we got 3 billion more people, that's going to be 3 billion more potential problems we've got. Just that alone would cause you to understand how much more complex things can become. And so, you know, anytime there's a lives hanging in the balance, it's an extraordinarily challenging issue. And what I would tell you, ironically, having just argued that leaders have to be alert to the fast pace, they also have to follow another dictum that I really believe, which is be quick, but don't hurry. Even in the most serious crisis, if you hurry, you'll make a mistake. You won't take the time to get the knowledge you need to establish the objectives that will actually lead to solving the problem, to marshal the resources, to make sure that the people who are going to execute your plan are aware of it, not only the details of it, but why it's important. So ironically, you've got, to me anyway, ironically, you've got this world that's moving faster, but the responsibility of leaders to manage the time available to them in a way that will allow them to solve the problems.
So there we go. Be quick, but don't hurry. A great piece of advice for General Martin Dempsey. Now we stare into the future a little bit. And one of my first podcasts, and one of the most remarkable for me personally, was sitting down with historian Peter Frankopan, author of The Silk Roads and The New Silk Roads. It was, for me, a great personal experience, but so much insight in that podcast. Now, we repeat it again. Although it's not timely, it is timeless. Listen to his view of what's going on in the world at the moment. And this was back in June 2020. We hear from Maggie Alfonsi, one of the greatest rugby players this country has ever produced, and Inga Beale. And then we finish yet again with former Prime Minister Tony Blair giving an optimistic take on what it might take to build back better.
I think always be careful asking a historian to crystal ball gaze. You know, if we were doing this in December, we'd have been talking about how this decade would be defined by Brexit and by David Cameron being the worst prime minister in living memory. And then probably in December, we said maybe that title Theresa May would have had a shot at. And now, you know, Boris Johnson is in comfortable first place in terms of the response and lack of visibility and lack of leadership. So a lot will depend on will we look back on this time, even 2 or 3 years' time, to say that was that weird window where for 4 months the world stood still, but actually there's been a recovery. We addressed some of these civil rights issues and about people's equalities. We addressed slavery, we addressed racism, we addressed Black Lives Matters properly. And it gave us an opportunity to reset. And in fact, will be a kind of blip. A lot will depend on what kind of medical interventions arrive and when. My own view, for what it's worth, is that this is a relatively benign, low-level pandemic. It doesn't kill, you know, it's taken, unfortunately, in this country, 50,000 lives, but, you know, hasn't killed on the scale that pandemics usually do. You know, so the Spanish flu 100 years ago killed somewhere between 30 million, which is sort of my ballpark. Some people think 50, maybe even more. The next levels of pandemic that we face will be much more dramatic. So this will be look like an early warning system to what we have.
In many ways, this could be the one. This could be a good thing in the sense it might prepare us for something that's far more virulent down the pipeline.
Correct. So I mean, it looks today momentous, epoch shifting. But I can tell you, if there's a contact between a US fighter plane later this afternoon in the South China Sea and it gets shot down, no one's going to write about COVID in 100 years. It'll be about the war between the US and China that went nuclear. you know, it'll be, you know, if there's a confrontation by North Korea or Iran that they decide this is the moment to take matters into their own hands and launch nuclear missiles against, you know, Israel, take your pick. Again, COVID and lockdown will be walk in the park. So because we expect the world is going to go back to normal, we hope that it will, we kind of can't imagine that anything will be more dramatic. So at the moment, it feels a little bit like asking, will a yellow card that a player gets in the 20th minute be what sunk England's dreams in a World Cup? There's so much of a match still to go. There's so many ways in which this can take worse turns. But, you know, as an optimist, I'd like to think that we'll work together, and that by and large, a lot of the rhetoric and the shouting off at each other doesn't go anywhere. But history tells you that when temperatures rise and people start accusing and shouting and insisting, it never tends to end well. That's the single biggest danger of the Trump administration, is that the inflammatory way that he talks about everything, that we now have a polarized world, not just because of around race, but around almost everything, around China, around trade, around jobs, around religion, about gender, about, you know, you name it. And that is more and more and more tinder that it doesn't take a big spark to light. So if we can get through with vaccines and reset, then great. But my guess is that in the grand scheme of things, dramatic though it feels,
So I still have aspirations to, you know, one day be the president of the RFU, one day be on the board as well of the RFU. So that's still something which I'm very much driven by. It's a fantastic governing body, and to be part of that at a higher end would be really good. I'm currently on the RFU council and learning a lot about the business and everything that makes the game. So that's my big aspirations. But you know, future after the RFU, that is, you know, who knows, one day want to be a CEO of a big business. So
I love the way you just put it out there. I want to be president of the RFU, and almost put it out into space. It's quite an interesting approach, really. It's a big thing to throw out there. Do you do that often? Do you kind of throw the big aspiration out there, in the fact that it forces you to get going on it?
Most definitely, Nick. You, as you know, once you've put the intent out there and you share your goal, all of a sudden there's more of a drive to have to achieve it. Also, I write it down. You know, there's a really good quote saying, "Think in ink," because once you put it down on paper, you've almost made it very clear what your goal is. So there's almost no excuses. And I also think when you start to share a goal and you've told other people, there's more people who go, oh, now I know what your goal is. I'm going to do what I can to help you. And that's what's happened. I think now I've been open about it. It's been really good to see the support across the leadership of the RFU to say, how can we help support you on that pathway?
When I put into context what you've spent almost your entire business life talking about is risk. And I wanted to know how your view of risk has changed in the last year, and whether looking at this fundamental threat, and you've probably spent so much of your working life talking about risk and threat and trying to measure that. How's your view on risk changed individually?
It's really changed from the world of the very physical to the world of the more intangible. Now, when I think back to 2001, you know, the tragic World Trade Center disaster in New York City, we were always used to modeling things like that. And actually, before that happened, one of the scenarios that insurers worked to was a plane crashing into one of the towers. We didn't anticipate that both towers would be affected. But fundamentally, we had scenarios like that built up, and we made calculations about how much it would cost. And we had done that for all sorts of physical scenarios around the world. It might be an earthquake in San Francisco or Tokyo, or a windstorm going through Europe, mm-hmm. anything like that. But it was all about the physical buildings, infrastructure being destroyed or damaged. Then what's happened, of course, is technology has transformed business models. So businesses now are much more reliant on virtual assets. And whether you're an Airbnb or a other technology company who gathers data, you don't really have physical assets in the same way that businesses used to. And I believe that something like 80% of the market value of the S&P 500 companies, some of the largest in the world, the asset values are now made up of these intangible risks that you can hardly get your arms around. And that fundamentally changed how we had to try and assess risk. How do these virtual assets get affected? What will a cyber attack do across the world, where we'd been very much used to physical boundaries and things? So a building had a physical footprint. That was what got damaged. Suddenly we were confronted with a cyber attack that put companies perhaps out of business for days or weeks. And it went across physical boundaries, so across country borders, you know, things like this. This really started to change how we looked at risk. And the difficulty in assessing these in this intangible side, I can't stress enough. And we still don't have the clear answers. Now, when it came to something like COVID, it was very interesting because then I really started to reflect. And some years ago, Lloyds did a study with Cambridge University about cities. So cities in the world, and they came up with some of the 100 sort of riskiest cities. And our focus then was on urbanization that was going on because the world was changing and people were moving into cities. They were going there for work. And so the whole way we all lived was changing. And we were thinking, well, if all of these cities are becoming so big, the risk, that sort of concentration risk is changing. Now, one of the factors, that came out, I think, in the top 10, sometimes the top 5 risks to those cities was a pandemic, was a human pandemic. And so we knew about this years ago. Experts around the world had been thinking about this and what it could mean. We'd even tried to guess on the financial impact. And in fact, we're probably way wrong, but we estimated for London that the financial impact to the GDP, to the gross domestic product, basically the economy of London, would be £700 million. That's what we thought a pandemic impact would be financially to London. Okay. We probably got it way wrong, right? But that was the kind of thing we're doing. But the thing is, nobody really got prepared for it. Mm. It's almost as though all these experts did this analysis and we said, yes, it's a threat. But what did we do? Nobody really got prepared for it. We didn't really build it into our business models and the way we looked at risk. So I think it's fascinating that you've kind of got experts around the world looking at probably not, you know, way beyond pandemics, but all sorts of topics. And we don't seem to be really listening to them because it's not part of our existing world or our prior world. So we kind of push it off to one side. So I think that's a really interesting thing for people to now think about in the future, how they're going to assess risk and what really are those important risks.
Where do you see our place in the world over the next 5 years? And with an optimistic, I'm looking for an optimistic slant at the moment.
Well, the only way of doing this sort of optimistically, because it, you know, as I don't want to go back over all the Brexit thing, but I do believe it was it's a terrible mistake for the country. But the optimistic scenario is that we build a set of strong relationships as an independent country out of Europe. You're going to have to build strong relationships with Europe because you can change your political alliances, but you can't change your history or your geography or your values, your interests, all of which are aligned with Europe. I think it's going to become very important for us to have a strong, very strong, you know, our armed forces are good, but we're going to have to rebuild their strength significantly. I think we're going to have to decide how we fit in the new world order, where you're going to have essentially by the middle of this century, you have three giants, which will be China, America, and probably India. And then you'll have what I call the tall countries. That's those countries with populations over 100 million people, you know, Brazil and Indonesia, Mexico, Japan, so on. And then you're going to have the countries who are more medium-sized like ours, but who can still be, you know, we're still at the moment the fifth largest economy in the world. We can still be very powerful players, but we're going to have to become centers of excellence and innovation. You know, and the best way to think of it is, you know, okay, let's treat what's happened as a kind of shock therapy. And now we're going to have to work out where we fit in the world, what we stand for. You know, this is why I'm very was always very much in favor of us having a strong overseas development portfolio, and why we increased aid so much, because I think, you know, this also helps Britain build alliances. And we're going to have to become a beacon, a model of what a modern economy and society should be. And that means, with the technology revolution being a center of technology innovation, it means in social terms, showing how you can bring people together, have a socially cohesive society where you spread opportunity. And it means in the world that people know you are using the clout that you have constructively in pursuit of good values and in alliances that are based on values as well as interests. But it's, you know, it's going to take, the only thing that worries me about the country at the moment is that it is going to take a lot of thinking and statecraft to get us there. It's not just going to happen. You know, we're going to have to think our way through to the future.
So there we go, 34 episodes wrapped into a nice, tidy hour. Thank you to Chris, the most patient editor in history, and Tom and Molly and the team here to really help pull off what we've done over the last year. I hope you've enjoyed it. Thank you for joining us as well. And thank you so much to the guests that have given up their time, their emotion and their storytelling. It's been wonderful seeing how sport plays a role across all types of people in the world. So we'll be back with some more episodes leading into the summer. Thank you for joining us. We're available to get you wherever you get your pods from Spotify or Apple or any other platform. Thanks for joining us. This was Life Beyond Sport.